John, if you're ready, I will go ahead and turn it over to you now.
All right, thank you. Hello, everyone. This is the last class, or, you know, actually the last, every class, and there's a lot of repetition. I was just thinking, a lot of the stuff that we've been meditating on, particularly the analytical meditation, will come up again in the three principles of the path. So that'll be, you know, repetition is a good thing in Buddha Dharma. You'll hear things over and over again. That's kind of the way to learn it, really. All right. So why don't we start out with, I think, you know, the most important aspect of karma is, other than whether it's virtuous or non-virtuous, the key thing is intention. You know, so your intention for doing something virtuous, if it's a virtuous intention, then the karmic fruit is much greater. And you know, the motivation could be something small, which is not saying there's anything wrong with just wanting to be happy and not stressed and, you know, not depressed and just, you know, have a peace of mind. I mean, that's definitely always my intention, probably every day I practice. It's not easy to expand the motivation out to others. In fact, in the beginning, the teachers say that, it's called effortful bodhicitta. In other words, it is so hard to think that you're actually practicing so that you can help others. That's the main motivation for practice. Usually we think about ourselves as the main motivation, but that's not the most powerful motivation. So let's do the prayers and then we'll do some guided, you know, some silent, you know, some mindfulness of the breath, and then maybe different kinds of mindfulness practices, and then we'll move on. Okay, so again, remember refuge. There's that dread of the bad, you know, dread, confidence, and compassion. Those are the motivations that we need to bring to mind, or the thoughts we need to bring to mind about why we're actually taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. All right, so I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And the four measurables, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, anointed, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha filling offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niyata Yami. So if we thought about the meaning, if we understood and thought about the meaning of those words, kind of sets the stage in a positive way for our meditation practice. Motivation is like the most magnanimous motivation, because it's really about, it's about others. It's, you know, sometimes we'll say, you know, the bodhicitta is like, you know, we, you know, the goal is to benefit others. The method is to develop our own minds. So that's where we, that's where we're going with the meditations we're going to do tonight. Do different ones at different times. But I think we like to start out by doing some, take some maybe deep cleansing breaths, and then do your mindfulness of your breathing. If you know, again, different people choose different places, the tip of the nose. You know, you can feel the air moving in and out as it kind of warm and cool. And a lot of people use that as a spot, but the rising and falling of the abdomen is another way, or just the whole experience of breathing in and breathing out, whatever works for you, or it could be something completely different that you focus on. But the point is to bring your mind to one-pointedness as much as possible, and then and we'll do that for 5 or so minutes. So again, always remember, no matter how many times your mind goes off, you start again. Just start again. Just start again. That's kind of like a mantra. Always bringing the mind back again and again and again. Just however how many times it takes. Sometimes you can make just a soft mental note if you're counting your breath. Sorry. Or you could just soft mental note out and out and, if that helps you stay focused. relax the concentration on the breath and begin to just pay attention to what arises in your awareness, and see if you can be almost like you're watching a play or listening to music or whatever, but you're aware that you're watching the play or listening to the music. You're not caught up in it or swept away by it. You want to be able to just notice whatever arises in your awareness. And again, notice how we have virtually no control over what arises. It's just thinking or just experiencing. And notice also how things are, you know, from a meditative perspective, things are changing moment to moment, like many times in the moment. And we said just in a finger snap, there's 60 mind moments. That's the way the Tibetans talk about it. So the mind is constantly in a state of flux. Subtle change, subtle impermanence. If you find yourself getting some memory of a person or situation triggers a whole essay on something, just notice that and then bring the mind back. Sometimes a very helpful way to get your mind back is when you're swept away is to softly note thinking, and there's a little soft note in your mind, thinking, and then when that, whatever it is, passes, you can bring your awareness back to your breath for a moment, then again, once again, relax your awareness and pay attention to what the content of your experience is, your inner experience. Sometimes it might be even more helpful to get more specific about what you're being aware of that's distracted you. It could be fear. Again, you could softly note fear, or sadness. Again, just noting what's there, mentally noting it, And usually when you do that, it passes and you're back to just being aware of the process of breathing, sitting, just being present. Like I said, when strong emotions arise, that's usually when we're most easily swept away. And that can go on for a long time before you even realize that we're gone, that we're no longer meditating, we're just ruminating. And so, again, when we notice a strong emotion like anger, and that's hard, that one's sometimes hard to let go, but noting it softly, putting a mental note on it, anger. Also experiencing what it feels like in the body as well. Being aware of that experience along with the mental noting. Now we're going to shift, we can just kind of stay in this meditative state, but we're going to shift to a different kind of meditation, this sort of what we call sometimes analytical or checking meditation. And we're going to start out with just this, the very basic teachings that are universal to all the different Buddhist traditions, the Four Noble Truths. When I try to teach this to my kids, which I've not been successful in doing, I might add, but they do remember this part. That, you know, I say, look, we're all sick, and there's a cause for the sickness. And the good news is, the great news is it can be cured. And then this is the medicine. So the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness. And I just, the Buddha started out teaching this way. He didn't start out talking about the path or liberation. He started talking about dukkha, which you might think that's not a very good sales pitch, but it's really describing the human condition. And some people cannot relate to it, and that's fine. I mean, it's just their karma. They think it's just negative and not helpful, but we're actually identifying the human condition and also identifying that which we can grow spiritually, grow beyond. So dukkha's the first. Yep, we're sick. All worldlings are deranged. Heard that one time. All worldlings are deranged. But, you know, it's just what it means to be in samsara, right? And the cause of it is karma and delusions. So that's the second noble truth. The law, the universal law of cause and effect. And then all our delusions, the one that gets the most attention is attachment. But all the delusions create karma that keeps us stuck in samsara. You know, there's greed or attachment, hatred, ignorance, pride, and jealousy. Those are sort of a big group. And then, again, there are 84,000 other delusions, according to Buddhist texts. So there's a lot of places that we're leaking oil, you might say. So any action motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance, pride, and jealousy, and any of those so-called negative states of mind, according to the law of cause and effect, will always lead to suffering. Always. And any action motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance will always lead to happiness. Which then leads us to the third noble truth. And it's, you know, this is sort of a lot of this takes faith. And so, you know, it's hard in the beginning. Maybe you don't haven't had an opportunity to put, you know, to give these teachings a real try. I think faith, in the Dharma, it takes years, maybe, certainly it takes years, probably decades, probably even lifetimes to develop strong faith. For example, that you can be liberated. Liberation, the third noble truth is the Buddha is asserting that the causes of suffering can be eliminated and we can be completely free of suffering. Completely free of suffering. That's what nirvana means. Freedom from suffering. What is the experience when suffering is gone? It's like complete peace and joy. It's like exactly what we've always wanted in our heart of hearts for ourselves. What would it be like? Imagine just for a moment, what would it be like to be a person and have no suffering? Not even a split second of an unhappy, dissatisfied mind, but just peace and joy all the time, 24/7. So that's nirvana. And then the path, and that's what's going to be, path is what the next module is about, really. It's about teaching about, and again, the path can be broken down, and as Rabina says, packaged in a lot of different ways. The three hour trainings of concentration, I'm sorry, ethics, concentration, and wisdom, they have more to do with just achieving nirvana. Those are the teachings that are maybe more emphasized in the Theravada tradition, whereas in the Mahayana tradition, you know, we have the three principles of the path, which is renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness, or the three, we sometimes call it the three scopes. We're talking about developing bodhicitta, the three scopes of practice. That's what constitutes the Lam Rim. I'm pretty sure that'll be talked about in some detail in the next module. But in any case, we have to develop renunciation of samsara. We have to be sick and tired. We have to realize that we're entrapped in a prison. If we don't get that, then there's no motivation for escaping. So we have to, and we also have to have some faith that it is possible to escape. Otherwise, there's no effort. So we have to see this determination, renunciation, determination to be free. Free of what? Free of suffering. And then bodhicitta is this altruistic intention to become enlightened based on love and compassion. So again, like I said, the goal is to become, it's not a wishy-washy kind of mushy thing at all. The goal is to become enlightened. Why? So we can liberate others. That is the purpose of us becoming enlightened is not just for our own happiness, but the emphasis is on liberating, helping other beings, our family, your children, your spouse, your friends, your coworker. You know, we have to make it real. All sentient beings is too much sometimes. We say that like it's like somehow we can relate to that, but we really can't. All sentient beings are infinite. But we can certainly relate to our family and our friends and coworkers and so on. That we want to become enlightened at least for their sake, the people that we care about. And then, so that's bodhicitta. And then the correct view of emptiness, seeing reality as it is. We talked about that at some length in this course. Again, realizing that sometimes it's called the object of refutation. So you can make a little mental note about that one. But it's basically saying that there's something in our perception that is distorted. That's a distortion caused by ignorance. And that is the object that needs to be refuted. When we refute that distortion, when we remove that, what we're left with is emptiness. Emptiness of this distortion. Reality is simply freedom from ignorance. So those are the three principles of the path. Then there's the tantric vehicle. And we haven't gotten into that. And there's one module, Introduction to Tantra, that is taught more toward the end. But anyway, I mean, Tara practice that's done at the center, a lot of the pujas, I mean, all the pujas, in fact, are related to tantric deities, tantric Buddha figures. And Lama Zopa and His Holiness the Dalai Lama I'm not going to, you know, guess she, Gellick would probably smack me down if he heard me call him a tantric adept. But, you know, I know that all of these great teachers are their principal practices are tantra. You know, that's their principal practice because it's the speediest way to achieve realizations. And there's a general, within tantra, there's four classes, which we can talk about, you know, in that class, but there's a generation stage of Hatha Yoga Tantra, and then there's a completion stage of Hatha Yoga Tantra. And we can, and it's in the completion stage of Hatha Yoga Tantra, if we qualify ourselves to be able to practice at that level, there's actually a possibility of achieving enlightenment in that, in this lifetime, using that particular technique, where we accessing the subtlest, most powerful level of mind to investigate and see reality as it is, and we can purify eons of negative karma almost like that. And it happens, this is the way it's described. So that's the whole path, you know, that is the fourth noble truth from the Mahayana Buddhist perspective. Okay, we can relax your attention, please. And anybody have any thoughts, questions, or comments?
Feel free to unmute and ask if you do have a thought or question or comment. And I will let everyone know that while you all were meditating, I did answer some of the questions we had before class about where to access or how to access things, as well as information about Buddhism in a nutshell. But feel free to unmute and ask a question if you have one. And I am monitoring chat on YouTube as well. So if anyone is streaming on YouTube and has questions or comments, feel free to add those to the chat on YouTube.
So who can tell me what the definition of meditation is? Hello.
I can.
You can raise your hand down here or up there. Yeah, what is the definition?
The definition of meditation is to become familiar.
Become familiar with?
I guess your mind.
Maybe. I mean, definitely that's part of it.
Is it clarity and awareness?
I mean, that's the nature of the mind, right?
The nature of the mind, okay.
Clarity and awareness. But I'll use Alex Berzin's definition, but it's familiarity. It's building up beneficial states of mind. You know, for example, if you have somebody at work, you know, you could just, that you hate, sometimes you could meditate for hours on their bad, their, you know, things you don't like about them. That's not meditation. Sitting there ruminating about people's, you know, negativities or whatever, but it's benefit is building, building up or cultivating beneficial states of mind. So that's kind of so it's a tech, it's a tool. It's, you know, it's not the end all be all. We don't, the whole point of meditating in the Buddhist tradition is basically to become a Buddha. I mean, just to become this person who can help anybody, anytime, in any situation, knows exactly what to do and does it. As to the, you know, to the degree that person has the karma to benefit from the presence of a Buddha, they benefit from that. So I have there's actually a public exam that came with this course. You don't have it, but I do. I might run through some of the questions that, at least in the early days of discovering Buddhism, when these classes first came out, the hope was that there would be like public exams and everybody would be asked to, you know, answer questions and, you know, basically be put on the spot. But one of the questions is, what's the difference between compassion and pity? Anybody want to answer that?
And again, feel free to unmute and answer. And don't worry if you're wrong. It benefits all of us to lead into.
Well, this is Janet. I'll take a stab at this one. I think of compassion as when you want to help someone, and pity is when you feel superior to someone.
Mm-hmm. I think that's good. I think that's I agree with that. I think there's definitely that pity. Almost feels like you're looking, oh, you poor you. I'm up here and you're down there.
Yes. Yeah.
You're saying. I think that's true. And compassion, again, the definition. See, this is the thing about it. These are words. Compassion is not made people be free of suffering and its causes. That's just the definition of Buddhist definition of compassion. Compassion is what we experience when we have transformed our mind into that experience where, if it could speak, would say, may you be free of suffering and its causes. It's like looking at your only child who's like got the COVID infection and you see them struggling, and you know, in your heart, you wishing them to be free of suffering and its causes. It's something that we transform our mind into in meditation practice. And then we familiarize ourselves with that experience again and again and again. The feeling associated with the cultivation of compassion deepens it in our, it sort of ingrains it in our being. We call that a realization, where you actually, it's no longer a conceptual understanding. It's like an intuitive understanding. So, let's see. Here's another one. I'm not even sure I can answer this one. How is it possible to have equanimity and also distinction? I need some help here, people.
You have to have wisdom.
Yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
please?
How is it possible to have equanimity and also distinction?
That's a confusing question.
It is a little bit, isn't it? Well, what do we mean by equanimity? Equanimity, sometimes it's described different ways, you know, like, sometimes it's like you're not, you know, the mind's not too excited, it's not too flat. In meditation practice, when the mind is completely calm, sometimes that's called an equanimous state of mind. But the way we've meditated on equanimity, and we will in a minute, because I think it's one of the best meditations that I've ever done in all of Tibetan Buddhism, is sort of equal regard for the three categories of beings that we focus on. The so-called friend that we tend to cling to, and then the stranger that we feel indifference toward, and then the so-called enemy or person that we feel aversion toward, we want to push them away, okay? And so equanimity, realizing that these are merely labels, that they can change at any minute. Friends can become enemies, enemies can become friends, strangers become friends or enemies. In past lifetimes, we've all been in every possible relationship with everybody, and so on. So we try to develop equal regard for all beings. So it is possible to, and then they say distinction. What do you think they mean by distinction? Having equanimity, but also distinction.
I don't know what they mean by distinction.
I'm not really sure what they mean. If I had to make something up real quick, I would think, for example, we are going to have friends, right? And, can we have, like, my family? I know I'm going to be closer to my family than strangers that I've never met or people that I've had problems with in the past and probably still do. But, we can still have, relationships with people. We can still remember that this person is a problem, a troublemaker, and we don't have to label them as object of aversion, I hate them and all that, but we can distinguish them as people that maybe not, we're not ready to get close to them. We're not, we need to be able to use our judgment. Like I said, wisdom, using wisdom in situations, at the same time having an equanimous state of mind, not being disturbed, because we want to become enlightened, not just for our friends, and of course, universal living beings. I mean, my gosh, the vast majority of beings are strangers. We don't have any relationship. We don't feel like we're even connected to them. And then, of course, the idea is to become enlightened for all sentient beings, universal living beings, without exception, equally, without any distinction. So it's difficult. It's really a challenge, but it's something, it is the foundation for developing universal compassion. Without equanimity, as long as we have this distinction between friend, stranger, and enemy, it is not possible to have universal compassion. We'll have biased compassion, biased toward the people we love, and when we see the people we hate suffer, we might even rejoice. So that's not good. Not where we want to go.
Maybe the distinction is that the amount of effort or wisdom or whatever, how you treat each of those distinctions is different. So you know if you're dealing with an enemy, you've got to be a little more focused, a little more on guard, not to slip into the negativity, and that's what distinguishes. Equanimity is there. It's just what distinguishes how you approach and deal with each individual,
mm-hmm.
what they try of your patients or make you happy.
Yeah.
Well, and it seems like as well you're having to distinguish between here's another person, they're a person just like you, they want to be happy, and you're distinguishing, they may have behaviors that you disagree with, but you're sort of distinguishing the behavior from the person at their core.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think that makes some sense. And making some distinction. Well, I think we've said enough about that. Let's move on to another question. Will the compassion make us weak? That's a good question. Will compassion make us weak? Are we going to become a doormat if we develop perfect compassion? Like, wishing everybody to be free from suffering. Is that going to make us weak? They spelled it W-E-E-K here in the question, but it was W-E-A-K, weak. Does compassion make you weak?
Again, I think it goes back to wisdom and having the wisdom to not allow that to happen and still be compassionate towards others. So you have to have both, the compassion and the wisdom.
Yeah. I mean, and can compassion look like a kick in the butt?
It could sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, this, you know, the Dalai Lama can be very fierce. I remember I had a friend who went in. She was bugging the heck out of the office of Tibet. I got to go see His Holiness. And when she finally got in to see him, he was wrathful with her. You know, in a way that she needed to be, anyway, in a way that was helpful for her mind. Not at the moment, later on she saw the value of it. But yeah, compassion can look quite fierce. You know, like not letting your child run out in the street. You know, having to raise your voice, but not out of anger, but out of compassion, because they don't hear you the first time. They didn't hear you the 10th time. So sometimes you have to go grab them, you know? So compassion can look so many ways. We cannot read other people's minds. The best chance we have of reading somebody's minds is what?
Being enlightened.
No. Watch what they do and listen to what they say. That's the closest we'll ever know, because we don't know what their motivation is doing. We can't know that. So, but at the level that we can practice, we can certainly, and for ourselves, watch our behavior and watch what we say, because, you know, that's how people are going to interpret the state of our mind. So, you know, that's important. So, you know, we have to, we cannot know people's motivation. They might do something that we would totally disagree with, and their motivation might be compassionate, but we can't understand it. So as all the great teachers say, don't judge people. Don't judge people. For goodness sakes, work on your own mind. Don't sit around and pick other people apart, but you have no idea what's going on in their mind. You have no idea why they did what they did. You know, you just have your interpretation of it. But in fact, their motivation might have been 100% compassion. They might be bodhisattvas, and you don't know it. That's where Lama Yeshe used to say that. You do not know who a bodhisattva is, so don't judge anybody. Best thing to do is take care of your own mind. Watch your own mind. So how is analytical and stabilizing medication? Meditation helpful in daily life?
I think, this is Joy, I think it helped me, or us, anybody, I think it can help us, to work with what Robina calls those disturbing emotions. And so, if I have an anger problem, if I can do analytical meditation on it, maybe I can stop the next time it begins to crop up. Maybe after meditating, it can make me at least stop and hold my tongue and think.
Right.
So I think it's very, very practical.
Another example that comes to my mind that would be like somebody that you dislike, that annoys you. All right, and this is part of when I try to do the equanimity meditation, I try to do it this way, where I'll think about somebody who's like harmed me either directly or indirectly, and I think, okay, they're harming me. Why? It's my own former karma. This is my karma coming back to me. The real source of the karma is my self-cherishing, self-centered attitude. The real enemy lives in my heart. It's not out there. And then the Bodhisattva Charyavatara Shanti Deva says, if somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get mad at the stick. You get mad at the person, right, who hit you with a stick. Well, the real stick, the person who's harming you is like the stick. The real source of the damage is our own former actions coming back to us. Furthermore, how do we develop, wisdom in terms of learning what not to do when we experience suffering? If somebody steals from us or cheats on us or does something, then we go, okay, I did that in the past. I need to remind myself not to do that again. So there's a learning, a teachable moment there for us. Also, we needed to learn how to develop compassion for people that are difficult, realizing that they want to be happy, just like I want to be happy. They're just like I am, just like all of us. We all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. Yet, they're so overwhelmed by their delusions that they're behaving in ways that are damaging to themselves and other people. So the appropriate response might be compassion. So here, if we do this kind of analytical meditation, and also, you can also go back to how things change. Like, the so-called enemy could become a friend. It's impermanent. It's a label. It's just a mere label. It's not the truth. It could change. We can do these kinds of analysis until we have a different perception of this person. And all of a sudden, this person that we maybe 5 minutes ago looked at and thought, I just really don't like them. So now we're feeling almost neutral, and then to be able to hold on to that neutral feeling without letting the mind go back and ruminate about the negativity. This is how you know, and this is how in our meditation practice, when you're doing analytical and stabilizing meditation, this is how it's supposed to go. We do the analysis until we come to a conclusion. For example, the enemy is not really an enemy. It's a label. It's not a permanent, inherently existent, you know, person or way of being. And so we get that conclusion, and then we hold that with stabilizing meditation. The experience of having let go of the anger and the resentment of this person, we hold that feeling for as long as we can with stabilizing meditation. Same way with when we're developing compassion, we actually transform our mind into compassion, and then we hold that with stabilizing meditation to deepen the realization of compassion. So all of these analytical meditations are meant to be conjoined with stabilizing meditation. We do the analysis, come to some sort of realization or conclusion that makes sense to us, and then we hold it in our mind for ever how long we can hold it. It might only be a 5 seconds. It could be a minute. Could be longer. And then oftentimes when we lose that, you know, that experience, realization, whatever it is, we go back and maybe do the analysis again until we come to the conclusion, and we go back to stabilizing meditation. So it's a very important part of meditation, is doing being able to combine analytical and stabilizing meditation. All right.
I have something.
Go ahead.
I think the enemies don't have to come as enemies, but they can be in your own circle of people, and they can start with some comments or competition or jealous. Those don't have to be coming from enemies. They can just come from in your own people, and you can be compassionate, keep being compassionate, go around and around, but it feels like sometimes it only gets, I don't think it will complete in this life of being compassionate and making total healing of the people. You know, it keeps going and going in circle.
No matter how much you
do for them.
Right, and I think the struggle is to, if you want to be indifferent just because you can't take it anymore, don't let it, because of compassion or understanding, let it become enemy. And you find future solutions to get back from stranger to friend, but not if all that negative behavior you experience doesn't change. I mean, it's got to be a balance. If those other people aren't making an effort, then it can't change no matter. You know, because we don't want to be, like we said, the doormat. So, that's what I'm doing now with a close associate that I don't associate with.
So, can anger ever be helpful? All you mind scientists out there who've been studying your mind for the last 6 weeks.
Not if you want to figure out good solutions.
Can anger ever be helpful?
I think it can spur you to action. If you see things happening that you don't agree with, you know, anger might be the catalyst for you to get involved and to try to improve the situation.
And I cannot argue with that. However, is there another alternative?
Yeah, I have a slightly different view on that. Although, you know, I can see the last person's point, I don't think anger is helpful. And that's coming from a person who has a core of anger. I run on anger. And as I meditate and that dissipates, it's way more helpful to not be running on anger.
You know, I've heard I'm sorry, do you have more to say?
Nope.
So anger is like drinking poison. If you're angry at somebody, it's like drinking poison, expecting the other person to die, isn't it? You know, it just poisons. It just poisons, and it's such a powerful poison. From a karmic perspective, anger is so powerful it can destroy our positive karma. I mean, that's hard to understand, but that's in the teaching we talk about how, you know, even a moment of anger directed toward a holy being can be very destructive to our positive karma that's been created in the past. But, you know, I think, you know, getting back to the first person's comment about how anger can be a catalyst for action, well, so can compassion, can it? And if we're, I remember the Dalai Lama talking about anger one time, and he said, I cannot imagine, he said, it might be possible for anger to be positive at some point. But he says, I can't quite see it. He said, because when our mind is consumed by anger, first of all, only one thing can be in the mind at one time. The mind's dominated by one thought, you might say, at a time. And when the mind is dominated by anger, the best part of our mind, which is compassion and wisdom, gone. No opportunity to operate. No opportunity to function. And so, again, it's possible. For example, when we see social injustice, you see people often, you know, rioting and getting all, you know, worked up and, you know, a lot of stuff, we've seen it happen in this past year. You know, and you go, yeah, there are good reasons to have things change. But is it possible to be motivated by compassion rather than rage and anger? And it is. Compassion can be a powerful motivator and you can be forceful. You know, everybody, again, this gets back to what I was talking about earlier. Compassion can be forceful. One of the first, if you look at the Buddhist iconography, the tantric iconography, I mean, the very first Buddhist, and particularly even in Kriya Tantra, the first level, you know, there's Tara, and there's Chinrezig, and they're all beautiful, and they're smiling. And then there's Manjushri, that has to do with wisdom. But then there's Vajrapani, who's this really fierce-looking guy with flames coming out of every pore in his body. But he's wise and compassionate. But he's a manifestation of the power of the enlightened mind, too. Sometimes it requires compassion, also requires power. And at the highest yoga tantra level, there's a deity that's in our tradition anyway, it's called Yamantaka. And Yamantaka is like, I can't even imagine. It's probably like in the Avengers, like the worst looking guy in all of the Avenger movies. That's what Yamantaka looks like, with fire coming out of every pore. But Yamantaka is about powerful, compassionate wisdom particularly, the power, but powerful wisdom and compassion, always with compassion. So there's plenty of of references in Buddhism where compassion can be fierce. It doesn't have to look like, oh, it's okay, dear, it's okay, you're going to be fine. It can be fierce. It can look a lot of different ways. Again, all the more reason for us not to judge people. Because we don't know their motivation. Could be pure compassion. But to us, it freaks us out. We think, man, that person is lost. But we don't know. Comment. Any thought about that?
What do we think about, like, the honesty part of that when you are being compassionate? Oftentimes it's honesty that is hard to deliver.
It's honesty that what, honey?
That sometimes it's the honesty that's hard to deliver. And people just will interpret that on a different level as maybe not being compassionate or being heartful.
Yeah.
But still coming from that honest place, I guess.
Right, right. I mean, that's what we, you know, that's the risk. I mean, if we're gonna be compassionate, but I have compassion manifest in a myriad infinite different ways, which is the way a Buddha could manifest compassion. You know, I mean, we're just baby Buddhas, right? But I think I do think there's room. I mean, we have to be willing to take some risks sometimes. That's what I say anyway. You know, I know there's plenty of times I've raised my voice at my kids and it has not been motivated by compassion, even though I thought I wanted it to be. I kind of, once you get rolling, you know, it's easy for anger to kind of come in there. That's why it's important to kind of cut it off quickly if you can. So let's take a couple of minutes, stretch your legs. We'll do one last meditation, do a bodhicitta meditation. Just a couple minute break. Well, we're having a break. I have a confession to make, which was just something I tried to do today. I woke up this morning and I said one of my motivations for the day was to try to practice Tonglen. Okay? Now, Tonglen is taking and, well, it's actually giving and taking. Okay? It's translated as give. It's translated as giving and taking, but most of the time, most of our teachers, they say, oh, it's about taking and giving, but tong means giving and len means taking. Okay, so I'm sitting at the. I tried to do it with my patients today. I completely blanked on it all day long. Didn't do it one time. Need to work on tomorrow's a new day, right? I can start all over again. But I was at the Division of Motor Vehicles today, and I was standing behind these people. And I thought, oh, I think I'll try Tonglen now. And so there was a guy standing in front of me. I didn't even know him. So it emphasized to me, and I've spoken to Geshe Gelug about it. In the Guru Puja, when that is the commentary on the Guru Puja, they talk about Tonglen, and they really do talk about giving loving kindness and taking suffering in that order. And it kind of makes sense, because if you don't know anybody, how are you going to sincerely feel love to them? If you don't have any feeling at all for them, how are you going to develop a feeling for them unless you stop for a long time and, you know, go back to past lifetimes and think about how they're just like me and want to be happy and don't want to suffer and like that. So, you know, this is important in Tonglen, is to, you know, it's not easy just to imagine taking somebody's suffering and giving them happiness. I think the first step is to develop a feeling of connection to people. And I know the Dalai Lama says he never meets anybody he doesn't feel connected to, because he sees everybody as family in past lifetimes. And who knows why? I mean, I think he sees a lot more than I could ever describe, but he understands that we're all the same. We all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. So I was looking at this guy, and I said, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness. I didn't feel anything. But then I went, okay, maybe you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And again, I really didn't feel compassion. I didn't feel anything. Then I did it again a couple more times, and then slowly I began to develop some feeling of connection to him and realizing that he's a human being like me, doing a little bit of analysis. May you be free of suffering and its causes. Okay, so we can practice Tonglen, particularly with difficult people, but in the beginning, with your family is a great place to start, the people that you love, because it's really easy to think, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness, and may you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Then you go to the people that are a little more distant, and you try to work with it. So Tonglen is, I think it's probably the most powerful meditation in all of Buddhism, for at least for us at the stage we're in. And it is the meditation that is so helpful in developing bodhicitta. So let's sit up straight, and we're going to do a kind of a real, maybe a 10-minute bodhicitta meditation. So again, just settle down and be aware of your body sitting, and the process of breathing. Relax your mind and body. So in developing bodhicitta, as we talked about earlier, the first meditation is meditation on equanimity. So bring to mind, just for a moment, the three categories of beings: the friend, the stranger, and the enemy. The person, you know, your enemy may be too strong for you, but just somebody that you feel resistance to, aversion toward, you prefer not to be in their presence, that's enough. But just those three categories of beings. And then using the kind of analysis that we've been talking about, how things change, even in past lifetimes we've been family, and, you know, so on and like that. Try to generate a sense of equanimity toward these three categories of beings, this level, equal regard for the friend, the stranger, and the enemy. You know, just remembering that these are labels, they're just labels, and that our ignorance projects, and it's just these different labels are based on some judgment that we're making in the moment, when in fact, as we said, the friend could become the enemy and the enemy could become friend, and strangers could go either way. So there's they're not fixed. And then we think of the next meditation is the analysis of something to think about is that all sentient beings have been like our mother. Okay, all, and again, this is one of those places where we have to creatively align with this, not that we can prove it, but just to play with this notion that there's no beginning. How could there be a beginning? Because you could say there's the first moment. Well, right before, it had to be something before that, and something before that, something before that. And we say that about consciousness. There's no beginning. So in every lifetime, we've had a mother. And so we imagine, to help us develop bodhicitta, that in fact, every living being has been our mother. Not only once, but countless times. I remember my teacher, Lama Yeshe, he used to always talk about kind mother sentient beings. Or he would even call people like mother, you know, like dad. Like project the name mother onto people that he didn't really know very well. Again, I'm assuming from this meditation of seeing all living beings as like family, like our mom. And that particular relationship is chosen, but you could choose any relationship that was really important and intimate to you when you were growing up. And then we remember the kindness of our mother. And again, if you have time, this, you know, children led a beautiful meditation on this. You look at from the moment you were conceived, your mom knew that you were growing inside of her belly, you know, in all likelihood, she was already deeply in love with you. You know, and you were just a little baby, just a little tiny thing. But already she felt love for you and carried you for 9 months. And the last, particularly the last 10 weeks for sure, probably had to go pee about every 5 minutes, couldn't get comfortable in bed, couldn't sleep, it's a struggle carrying, you know, that much weight around in your abdomen. And so, you know, it's a huge effort, but your mom, she didn't begrudge you for that. She loved you and was willing to do whatever it took. And then when you were born, you know, assuming you were born the natural way, I mean, you know, it's like her bottom splitting open. And, you know, you come out, it's extremely painful. Human childbirth is extremely painful. Unless you have an epidural nowadays, which most people opt for, but you can see it in the animal world as well. It's not comfortable. But your mom did that, and as soon as you were born, and the doctor or whoever it was, the midwife, put the baby on your breast, on the mother's breast, and she all the pain, all the suffering, whatever she went through for 9 months, whatever she went through for the last 12 hours of labor, all she could think about was you and your well-being. That's all she could think about. How much she loved you, like more than anything in the world. So powerful. So all of our past mothers have been just as kind to us as our mother of this life. And our mother of this life taught us how to walk and talk, took us to school that first day. For sure, she was crying when she drove away. And when we were 18 years old and went off to college and the nest was empty, she thought, oh, I'm going to miss her or him so badly. And even to this day, you know, even to this day, people that own, you know, prisoners and people that have done horrible things, the person that usually cannot believe that their child did this is usually the mom. Oh, I can't imagine that my Johnny would ever do that. You know, so mothers have that kind of single kind of, many mothers, not all mothers, but have that kind of dedication and love for their children. So we try to imagine that all mother sentient beings have been as kind to us as our mother has been to us. And we develop the wish to repay that kindness. It's not somebody else's responsibility. It's my responsibility to repay the kindness of all mother sentient beings. Okay? Then we meditate, contemplate on how we're all equal. We're all equal and wanting happiness, and we're all equal and not wanting to suffer. The Dalai Lama says he does this meditation. He imagines this is an imaginary line. On one side is him. On the other side are universal living beings, countless universal living beings, maybe in human form. And he says, you know, he says, I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. And then all these sentient beings are saying, I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. Everybody wants the same thing. And then the Dalai Lama says, whose happiness is more important, the happiness of one or the happiness of infinite universal living beings? It's a question. And many times, you know, people have given their lives for others because you know, they saw the happiness of others as more important than oneself. But at least equal, right? At least we equally want to be happy and equally don't want to suffer. And in that way, we are equal. Something that when you're with somebody tomorrow, that's something, I remember Jeffrey Hopkins said, this is something that we know very intimate about every body we meet. We know, this is so intimate. We know exactly what they're thinking. Not exactly what they're thinking, but we know what their thoughts are. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. That's something that is universal. Something that we all have. We all want that. And what is the cause of suffering? The cause of suffering is selfishness. The Buddhist is this falsely projected sense of I, the self-centered I. We sometimes call it self-cherishing, but sometimes that can be misconfused because cherishing sounds like a good thing, but it's really self-absorbed. It's self-cherishing selfishness. It's where we think of ourselves as the most important one, and if somebody offends me, then I get angry. And if somebody's nice to me, then they become my friend and I get attached to them. And so you know, all the 10 non-virtuous actions, at least the ones that are easy to see, the body and speech, all motivated by self-cherishing, right? Self-cherishing ignorance, killing, self-cherishing ignorance, stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh speech, frivolous speech, all motivated by self-absorption, a self-preoccupation, a self-cherishing ignorance, anger, hatred, attachment, fear, everything motivated by this absorption, this sort of preoccupation with self. So, you know, the real source of our suffering is our ignorance that projects a false sense of self and believes it and cherishes it. And the cause of happiness is cherishing others. It's cherishing others. It's antithetical to self-cherishing. All of a sudden, the energy has switched. The polarity has changed. And now we cherish others. We can get up in the morning and take a shower and put on nice clothes and eat breakfast to take care of our body so we can help others. You know, we can do our job well so we can benefit others. In other words, this attitude of cherishing others, it needs to pervade every action of our body and our speech, and eventually our mind. Lama Zopa was a bumper sticker. For happiness, cherish others. That's simple. For happiness, cherish others. And so the next meditation is just exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others, which is what I was just talking about a moment ago, where ordinarily we think of ourselves first, but now we gradually began to think of others before ourselves. And it's a process. It takes time. But we gradually want, at least aspire, to be able to exchange our self-cherishing selfishness for this attitude of cherishing others, so that cherishing others pervades our every action and thought. And then the next meditation, which is Tonglen, which is, you know, giving love and taking suffering. And whenever you do Tonglen practice, and it's always said, you should start with yourself. So let's just do it. We can do family and friends and strangers and enemies and all the beings in the hell realms and all the beings in the Prater realm and the animals and the hungry ghosts and the humans and so forth, all the different realms of samsara. We can work with them. But start out just for the next moment. Just imagine yourself and you've got from wherever you are until you die, and you can wish yourself happiness, thinking, again, this little voice silently in your head, may I be happy and have the cause of happiness, and may I be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May I be happy and have the causes of happiness and be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Just do that for a minute. And you can even, as you're imagining an imaginary self of you in front of yourself, you can breathe out like white light. You can imagine that you're breathing out this white light, which symbolizes happiness and its causes. It completely fills you up. And then all of your suffering, all of your future negative, all the negative karma that's going to result in future suffering for you, you know, leaves your body and in the form of black smoke, and then you breathe that into your heart, and that, so that self-cherishing that you, and suffering that you breathe into your heart goes right down the, to your heart and destroys your self-cherishing. Taking on the suffering of others is exactly the opposite of what the self-cherishing mind wants to do. And so when we do that, it destroys self-cherishing. And so we can imagine using white light, breathing out white light, which is happiness and its causes, and breathing in suffering or misery or negative karma, our own negative karma, and imagining that destroying our self-cherishing. And then the next contemplation is called the Supreme Wish, or I think the Supreme Wish, I've heard it calls different things. Bob Thurman calls it a messianic vow, which is a weird way of saying it, but it's basically saying, I am personally responsible for the happiness of universal living beings. You know, and it's based not on sentimentality or anything like that, but it's based on all these preceding meditations which have helped us develop a feeling of love and compassion toward others. So now we think, I am personally responsible for their happiness, helping them to find freedom from suffering and find pure, lasting joy and happiness, all the way up to the happiness of full enlightenment. It's my responsibility. This is the Bodhisattva's vow, which sounds crazy, but it's an attitude, it's a state of mind that a Bodhisattva has, is that you, no matter who they are, there's no distinction between friend, enemy, and stranger. I'm personally responsible for the happiness of universal living beings. It is my job and my job alone. That attitude of universal responsibility. And this is hard for a lot of people to think this way. And so some people, you know, people who are attracted to the Mahayana tradition may not have as much trouble as other people. They have the karma to be attracted to this kind of thinking. The next step is actually the generation of bodhicitta, where we recognize that even in our heart of hearts, we want to be able to guide beings from whatever their current state of suffering is to supreme enlightenment. But we haven't even achieved that for ourselves. The only being that can truly guide someone from, you know, from their current state of suffering to supreme enlightenment is a Buddha, a fully enlightened being, someone who's eliminated their faults and developed perfect compassion, perfect loving kindness, perfect wisdom, perfect power. All the qualities that make up an enlightened being, a Buddha, is perfect skillful means, knowing what to do in any situation that's going to best serve that being. So only person that can do that is a Buddha. And so we make the determination based on love and compassion to set our sight on supreme enlightenment in order to help others. We set our sight. Again, this is effortful bodhicitta. This is not spontaneous bodhicitta, but this is how we need to train our mind. We set our sight on supreme enlightenment for ourselves, practicing all the aspects of the path in order to be able to perfectly guide and serve others. The only purpose for achieving enlightenment, truly, is to serve others. If all we wanted was happiness, we could have gotten off at the train at the Nirvana station. That's happiness. That's joy. That's free, that's individual freedom. But if we want universal freedom for all living beings, this is the attitude that we have to develop. I must become enlightened in order to liberate all sentient beings. And it's based on sincere love and compassion. So just for a moment, see if you can hold that thought using stabilizing meditation. I think that's a good place to end. Let's read our dedication verses and we'll wrap it up, Linda. Okay?
Okie doke. Let me get those up. Hang on 1 second. There they are.
All right. And so we'll do this together, but you'll only hear me. Dedication verses from Master Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, or the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing. May the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth. Those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Okay. So thank you, everyone who showed up every time and everyone who showed up one time. Thank you for your attention, because, you know, we, by being here, we support each other's practice, and that's a contribution. And we can be sure that a lot of positive seeds were planted over the last 6 weeks. You know, I don't know about this class, what I did, but I know in your own meditation practice, you planted a lot of seeds, and they will definitely ripen in happiness and the causes of happiness. So you should rejoice in whatever effort you put in to this class and into discovering Buddhism in general. So thank you for the last 6 weeks. I look forward to the next one. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Good night.